Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, I'm Tommy. I'm an alcoholic. I'm really honored to be here. I remember going to this meeting when I had 10, 17, 24 days or whatever. And literally looking up to the people who stood up there, and it's like a great honor to be able to be like the speaker here. So just to get, to start with like the basic AA biography, my sobriety date is December 22nd, 2013. I have a sponsor. We work the steps. What that means is that I call them on a pretty regular basis. I try to do it every day, but realistically 4 or 5 times a week. And we meet together and we read through the book. And as we hit the steps, we work those steps. I'm currently working with 3 sponsees. That's a recent thing for a while. I didn't have sponsees, and before that I had a couple. So, that's new for me. I'm really excited about that. And so I guess I'd briefly, 10 minutes is pretty short, but I just briefly like to talk about my childhood. I don't think that the things that happened in my childhood make me an alcoholic. I think what makes me an alcoholic is what happens when I put alcohol in my body. And when I put alcohol in my body, I develop the phenomenon of craving, and I become obsessed with alcohol, both while I'm drinking and when I'm not drinking. So like during the day, going to class, whatever. But in my childhood, my parents had a pretty messy divorce, and I was the proxy between a lot of conflict between the two of them. And so not only did I learn to lie to both of them, but I learned to lie to my classmates, to pretty much everyone. And then basically I learned 2 lessons. The first of which is the best way to lie is to try to believe the lie yourself. And the second is that if you can convince people that nothing is wrong, people will just give you a pass and they can like pretend to treat you normal. Like you have like a 90% chance of doing that. And I think that that attitude is what kept me going through high school, through college. And the reality is, like, I got through both of those with a really severe drinking problem and a really severe drug problem, and it all ultimately caught up to me. And during that whole time, I convinced myself that nothing was wrong. To just give you an example of what my drinking was like, I mean, in the beginning, I was drinking more than my friends. We were going out on, like, whatever, Tuesday or Thursday night, which is not normal for high schoolers, and I would drink way more than my friends. I'd be the one who wanted to, like, finish the fifth, and they wouldn't, and I'd be the one falling down and like getting scars in my head. I guess I just didn't see it as a problem. That I knew that alcoholism ran in my family. I knew that, and I just thought that like, it's all right. Like I'll be able to handle this. I'll be okay. And as my drinking progressed, when I was like a freshman in college, I was blacking out pretty much every time I drank. I was drinking 3 or 4 times a week. I got into Adderall, which is basically just amphetamines. I was using it as amphetamines just to keep partying harder and then to study during the day. Around that time, I got into benzodiazepines. They were like psychedelics. They're just like all kinds of like, I will abuse anything given the opportunity. Even if I think like I initially don't like it, like I'll just get straight into it. My sophomore year of college, I joined a really fratty fraternity. It was like the fraternity for like the water polo players. And like, if you look at me and you can hear me speak, like that's not my personality at all. But like, I wanted to surround myself with people who drank and partied like I did. And like ultimately I drank and partied way too hard. I had to leave. I left. I went abroad, and that's when like my worst drinking happened. And I think everyone has a story where they're like, that happened and any sane person would have stopped drinking, but I kept drinking. And my most extreme version of that story, and sorry if anyone's heard it before, was that, I went abroad to Thailand, was drinking a lot, rented a scooter, decided to drink and drive the scooter, crashed the scooter, then woke up in a hospital, kept drinking. I spent another week I was on this island, and I had to like withdraw money, and there was like a withdrawal limit. So like stuck on this island for a week, and I went back to Bangkok. And at the time, Thailand was like fucking falling apart. There were going to be protests between the red shirts and the blue shirts. The U.S. embassy was saying, get the fuck out. And like, all I could think about was like, I want to keep getting fucked up. I want to find a doctor that I can manipulate to get more benzodiazepines. And like, I did both of those things. I was just totally ignorant of, like, I lost my passport while I was there. And I ended up going to the embassy, and they, like, finally going to the embassy. Like, I had to borrow money from my parents. And at the embassy, they gave me a passport in a single day. They were like, all right, come back in 2 hours. We'll give you a passport. Get on a plane. Leave tonight. And so I just, like, couldn't conceptualize. I mean, like, ultimately, in the place that I was staying, there were riots. A bunch of people were killed. It was, like, really shitty. I just couldn't conceptualize that was happening. All I could think about was, like, getting fucked up and, like, still getting fucked up, you know, doing whatever I could to do that. And then later in that time, like, I had a seizure. Thank you. Okay, so I kept drinking. I moved into this co-op. I did more drinking. I mean, that's obviously, right? And I had my first exposure to rehab. And I actually went into rehab because I had lost an Adderall prescription. And my psychiatrist said, I won't give you back your Adderall prescription unless you go to rehab. Rehab doesn't work if you're trying to get your Adderall prescription back. But it did give me exposure to 12-step meetings. I came to some meetings. I remember that. I remember coming to Wild Bunch. I remember being really intimidated by Wild Bunch. And it's hard for me now to really empathize with where I was at, but I just, like, didn't get it at the time. I knew I was an alcoholic, and I thought to myself, like, all right, I'll just keep doing this. It'll be all right. I kept drinking. I got into heroin. Super shitty. Got off of that. Kept drinking. Yeah, it sucked. And I kept drinking after I got off of heroin with Suboxone. It was like, the entire experience was, like, it was brutal. It was, like, physically... everything hurt. Yeah. And so I graduated from school and I got a job and I realized that, like, my style of drinking just wasn't, like, it wasn't compatible with what I wanted to do. And I was having that experience where on Friday I would go and I'd have one drink and then I'd wake up, like, just Monday morning, like, what the fuck? How did I get here? Now I have to go into work. And it was terrible. I drank my way through Thanksgiving of 2013. And on December 22nd, 2013, I decided to stop drinking. And I think... like a week prior, I'd had that realization, like, I am, like, oh, I get it. Like, I'm not in control anymore. Like, someone else is at the wheel. And I think that, like, when you have that realization, because I think I'd had it before, it's like you have to, like, jump on it, you know? You have this little window of time where you're, like, you're clear-headed and you, like, need to go to a meeting. And I did that. And I went to Wild Bunch on Christmas night of 2013. That was my first meeting back. So it sounds like really dramatic. It was really cool. To talk about what it was like when I started coming to meetings, I was scared shitless. I was scared of everyone. I thought people, like, wanted to, like, use or manipulate me. And I found it really difficult. I ended up getting a sponsor, like, a week and a half in. I was, like, really scared of doing that. I really didn't trust him. But I started following his recommendations. So I tried to do 90 and 90. I did, like, 85 and 90. I got commitments at meetings, and I started to fellowship with people. So at a lot of young people's meetings, we, like, hang out afterwards, we go and get food and all of that. And that, like, that community of people has, like, really saved me. And I've really been able to, like, lean on that community of people when things have gotten shitty. I started working the steps. And I think just to talk briefly about, one, two, and three, I think that one of the things that kept me out of the rooms, like, I have family members who are in AA, and I just had this, like, this notion that AA was, like, this religious cult that, like, demanded that you believe in, like, Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior, and then, like, then you would, like, be accepted and it would be okay. And, like, I mean, obviously that isn't true. But I came and I still thought, like, all right, like, I'm definitely an atheist. Like, I don't believe in God, you know, and I, what I've come to realize is that I have this whole, like, academic belief around God and whether or not God exists. And then I have, like, a spirit, like, spiritual experience. And those two things are, like, completely separate. So I think what I ended up doing is coming up with this, like, thinking my way around, like, how I could read the big book and how I could, like, read higher power and, like, how I could pray and all of those things. But, like, ultimately it doesn't matter. I said that, like, all right, like, I'll try to do the steps. I believe that this program works for other people, and I believe that it can work for me. I just had, like, enough willingness to actually do it and go through with the steps. Going through my fourth step, I realized that I had a very small world, you know, and it was home, work, liquor store, And I was resentful. It was so small, and yet I was resentful at everyone inside it. It was every, like, single person. And I just think, like, I hadn't seen that. So I had that realization. It wasn't, like, a sudden spiritual transformational experience, right? Like, I feel like it talks about in the big book, that my experience has been, like, of the educational variety. But that's what I would describe. Like, if I had to describe the difference between how I feel today and how I felt on December 21st, 2013, the day before I got sober, I just have, like, a radical shift in my perspective. And the way that I, like, think about my life, I think about other people, I think about, like, just the world in general has totally changed. I'm still working on it. I'm still working on it. I think, you know, I have these character defects that come up all the time where I'm, like, jealous or greedy, and I have these fears that are, like, fear that I'm not going to get enough of whatever I need, and fear, especially fear that I'm inadequate. And those things are just, like, they can be daily. Like, on Thursday, I did this, like, experiment where I'd, like, pray every time I had these thoughts that made me feel fucking shitty about myself, and it was, like, every 10 minutes. It was unreal. And so, like, those are the things that I'm working on now, and that's why I keep coming back, because I believe that, like, by continuing to work these steps, my life will continue to get better. You know, new job, wonderful friends in the program, like a wonderful community. So yeah, I'm happy to be here, and thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
Response, you say. My name is Susan. I am an alcoholic. And, you know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And as you are sharing, you have three sponsees, you know, just that, you know, I have none at this moment. I could never hold on to sponsees. I had a few weeks ago, you know, that my one friend, she was calling and she said, I want to commit suicide. And I thought, okay, you know, let's look at this. We want to kill ourselves, right? That makes us a killer, right? That makes us a murderer, and didn't want to go there, you know? And I do believe, for me, the only way Alcoholics Anonymous has worked to really, really be rigorously honest with myself. And I could not even give that to myself, you know? I received it like as a gift. Some people talk about the gift of desperation, and I do believe today that I did have a somewhat very low bottom. It included homelessness and dumpster diving and just really coming to a level of life that I should not have been, if I think about it, you know. Nobody should be there. And I just defended that lifestyle. A friend once visited me at my van, and he said, you know, my German friend, I was born in Germany, and he said, Susan, you know, you are homeless. I said, no, look, I'm camping. And he said, no, dude, you're really homeless. And I said, you know, that was the last time we have seen each other. There came a time in my life where even my good friends, you know, we just didn't see eye to eye anymore. And it's a sad, sad situation, you know. I had to drop out of university. My brain just wasn't working right. And I knew I couldn't do it, you know. I couldn't do these textbooks. We had to look at English textbooks. And I just knew up front I couldn't do it, you know. And this is the story of my life. I failed at everything. My life is paved with just nothing but one failure after another, one huge traumatic chunk after another. And I never knew how to deal with anything. I never learned what to do. I was just always headstrong out there. My will was carrying me, you know. And I remember I dropped out of university and I went to college. And that was the first thing I really loved to do, you know. I went to a design school. And it was just so great. It was for me actually really good because we had a practical approach there. I had to learn tailoring and you know, this, all this kind of stuff. And I just love to do this, you know, working with my hands. And I had good friends. I had friends from the art department. I had friends from the architectural department. And they were all cool, you know. I was never cool. I was never really a designer. I mean, I know it when I see it, but come up with something original, yeah. And nothing was given to me, I tell you that. And these friends, I had great friends. It was so much fun, and we were out there, you know, design is everything, right? And so, it was called the School for Communication Design. So whatever shirt you're wearing here, you know, we communicate something. So anyway, these friends, your good friends, they came to my apartment and they were holding a beer in their hand, and drinking is a big part in Germany. It's just part of people's lives. And they were holding their beer and they said, "Susan, we want to have a little talk with you. You know, your drinking is just sort of violent and strange. And we are a little bit concerned." And, you know, I said, if you don't like it, you just don't have anything to do with me." And, you know, as I get older, those were two good friends. I have never seen them anymore. I've never talked to them anymore. It was my will against you all, you know. And with this self-righteousness, right? It was it's tragic. We're just there. I mean, not even talking about homelessness, but losing one friend, one good friend, at least half. I mean, we are all halfway decent people, right? Before we get here. I mean, it really, really sad. So, but I was right, you know. I was always right, and I was never wrong, and I defended my position to the death. And, you know, in thinking about that today, I came to this program. I'm actually an old timer. I feel just new at this all. I don't think I ever spoke in front of a big crowd. And I came to this program when I was 30 years old, and I am 58 now. So, you know, I should know, right? I never went for a birthday trip because I love to smoke weed. In Germany, you know, in Germany that is hash, right? And that was just my favorite drug. I would just go through the night to get some hash when I was out. And then, the good part is, I cannot remember when I finally got to quit that weed. I was sitting in the meetings and I was going to tell you that it's okay to do the herbal stuff. It's good for you. It levels out you. And it really, and then I heard people's story, you know, one alcoholic telling another. That's the principle of this place. And there is something in that, you know. We say a loving God as he may express himself in this group conscience. And yeah, you know, there is something. If you tell me what happened to you and I tell you what happened to me, and the people laughed about weed. And I thought, "Oh, really? What's wrong with you?" And so I heard a few stories about weed. And you know how this is? The meetings are so silly. People go, "Ha, ha, 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 ha," just at the drop of anything, right? And they just kept laughing about it. And then I realized, you know, man, I'd been smoking that stuff for a long, long time. And I thought, now maybe I couldn't really quit. And then I did what we do. I started talking about it, you know. I had a little stepson. He was something else. I mean, He started smoking weed, you know. And I thought, what? So I started talking about this. I told people how dependent I was, how I had been living my life always with either hash or weed, that all my friends who smoke that stuff, they can never find out that there's something wrong with them. They will never find out. They just don't know. I said, do some heroin, you know, or smoke cigarettes. After 25 years of smoking, you know you are fucked, right? but not with weed, you know, weed. You know, my one sponsor called it, yeah, a dog trying to be God, you know. And so I kept talking about it, you know, like how fucked up this weed is, because it's so horrible and you think it's so beneficial and you just don't know how you just go down. And so in a way I thought it was just one of the more, you know, one of those drugs that are really delusional. So I came to see it, and by talking about it and talking about it, I finally got clean myself. And it just happened. It just, I didn't even really notice it, but it became one of these gifts of the program, you know. And what did I do? The people in the program said, you know how they talk. Get a sponsor. Get a book. Walk the steps. What? I mean, I tried, right? I really did. I was super, super sincere. I mean, I was so glad that something interesting, something new had opened up to my wretched life. Reading the book, I had a sponsor, she sat with me, reading the book. And, you know, we read two pages and I noticed I hadn't listened to the, after two sentences, I was gone. I couldn't listen. Then I repeated, and again, after a paragraph, I was gone. Couldn't pay attention anymore. So whenever, you know, I didn't want to struggle and try. I was in such bad shape. I was just so saddened and so depressed and so angry. My life had been bad for a long, long time. So I had this train going around and around in my head, and I wasn't myself anymore. You know, and I was married to a heroin addicted husband, and he was a really nice guy, and that wasn't all a delusion. That was intuitively, I know I wanted to marry this guy, you know. And I was so depressed and so deprived, and I came into the program. Indeed, I was just super skinny. I was chain smoking cigarettes, and I thought, okay, I look at this. I'm going to learn about the alcoholism of my husband, and I sat there. I still had this huge ego, you know, this war. This don't find out who I really am, you know, because I'm it, and you don't need to know. Don't, you know, just like a barrier, like a, you were not supposed to know what was in here. I mean, I made sure of that. And the wronger I got and the darker my life was, the more I blew an ego, like I just unbelievable, you know. I mean, arrogant, judgmental, and, you know, and they said, there are those two who suffer of grave emotional and mental disorders. Yeah. I could see that this was all these people I was seeing, you know. And so I sat there and I just thought, okay, I learned something about the alcoholism of my husband. And then one day, you know, I kept coming back, Berkeley Fellowship, 86 and 87 and Alcoholics Anonymous was a huge movement then. I mean, it really was a cult, you know, a group. I looked the word up. A group of people coming together in a single-minded purpose. You know, if we come together for stitching, knitting, patchwork, that is a cult, according to the. So why? If not, why not? Right. So I sat there and I just and one day, you know, they said, Susan, would you like to share? I said, oh, no, I pass. And behind me, somebody said, oh, no, you can't. You have to share. And I was shocked, you know. At that time, I still took everything everybody said really personal. And it hit me just here, you know, sure, asshole. And so I shared. And I don't know what was, I really don't remember what I said. I just remember I helplessly started crying, you know, me crying, and I couldn't stop, and I was given a handkerchief, and people just, yeah, oh, God, and then, you know, after this meeting, it just so happened, there was always this guy with a cool jacket, that was my level of understanding. I couldn't really see who was with us. I just thought, this guy has a cool jacket. And that was enough for me to keep coming back. That's that was the depth of my understanding. And this guy with a cool jacket, he came up to me and he said, Susan, you know, you just resolved your first step. You can move on to the second and third, and isn't it great? You never have to drink anymore, you know? And I just felt me having that depth I had. I thought, hey, I have accomplished something. It felt good, you know? I mean, me who had been crawling in dumpsters, I had accomplished something in AA. I was so happy, you know? I thought, well, that's something different. That feels good. And I kept coming back. It was, AA was big then. You walked the street of Berkeley and you just, yeah, hey, yeah. You know, it was like, I mean, they were everywhere. It was a huge party, and you just had to be there. You just sort of thought, yeah, it's happening, you know. Just I sat in the meeting, and I was just so smart. And, you know, and they read the how it works. And one day, you know, I had heard it many times. One day I heard, yeah, there are those two who suffer of grave, emotional, and mental disorders, but they do have the capacity to be whatever. It just hit me. And from that day on, I knew they were talking to me. They were not talking to my husband. They were not talking to you. I heard they were talking. It was me. And that's, you know, that was probably the first spiritual experience I had in the program of Alcoholic Anonymous. And I got really, really sincere. And, you know, I was really sad, you know. I had my crying face, and I was very dramatic. It would feel good. I would go to Friday night speaker nights, and I have a handkerchief, and I cry. And it was, I mean, yeah. And it was just, I just identified with people's stories. I could not stay outside, see. I mean, I had nothing in me. I was not informed. I was outformed. I had to just always look to the outside for what it was that I wanted, what I could get, what I could make of myself. There was inside. There was nothing there. I was truly mentally deprived, spiritually deprived, mentally ill. I finally could see it, you know, and I kept with it, you know. I just. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness. We hear it over and over again, but those are the essentials of this program. I didn't know that back then. It just came as a gift. Suddenly, the sadness, you know, I had willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness. I had nothing else. And I was still young. I really wanted a better life. I wanted to learn. And I wanted to have something that I could say, well, freedom, right? I mean, I still had this sickly enthusiasm that I thought, I can do it. And so I was sad, you know. My home life was terrible. I was sad. And the sponsor said, yeah, you will experience that sad gladness or that glad sadness. I was like, ooh. And he said, you will be sad because up to this point, your life has been a terrible mess. And you will be glad that from now on, it doesn't need to be this way any longer. And I thought, yeah, okay. You see, I couldn't get a sponsor, work the book, work the steps, read the book. That just wasn't in my capability. I mean, I tried, really tried, but I needed these little... I met a sponsor. He was the father of a friend of mine, you know, and he had this wisdom, and that came as another gift of God. I'm convinced of it, you know. He told me stuff. It was so simple, you know. This working and working, and you have to work, work, work. I had work, 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 but I never had gotten anywhere, so I was sort of careful with that. And then in the program, I've never, ever seen anybody find salvation just through their work, work, work. As a matter of fact, last year we had a young man in the program. He was just brilliant. He worked the steps with people, he explained them to us. Last year he committed suicide, you know. So it's an individual thing. Don't take anything anybody says here too personal, because people might not be right for that particular moment, you know. This old man, the sponsor, you know, he said, Susan, you have to learn to do nothing. I mean, he could see I was fried. I was like this. And it wasn't the DTs. I knew this. I still had brains enough. I was shaking when I made a phone call. When somebody said something, I started shaking. I wanted to start shaking. I tell you, just when I started here, you know, I did not feel good about this. I have been in fear all of my life, in fear of failing, you know, because I failed so much, couldn't do it anymore. I didn't meet the expectations, you know. And the sponsor said, Susan, you have to learn to do nothing. Just see the need for patience, and patience will come. And I just, wow, you know. That was stuff that I could take home, and I just see the need for patience, and patience will come. That's like almost all the steps combined, right? So now I could see I was just impatient, I was out of control, you know. And I was sitting in these meetings, and I started to share a little bit. God, we heard some crazy stuff, you know, people going in and out. My husband then joined me for a speaker night, and he had gone to Berkeley High School, and he naturally met all these people, but, you know, he was too smart for the program, let's just start, you know. I was born in Germany, in Hamburg, and my dad was an immigrant to Germany. He was from Iran. My mother was German, and we had one crazy, crazy household, you know. We had, my dad was trying to get the son, and the son just came once, and the son was severely disabled and retarded. My older sister was born severely disabled. They call this now, I don't even know the name for that. Back then you called that physically and mentally retarded. My older sister was born this way, and my only brother, and back then we were four children, later we were six. I was the third. Everybody yelled at each other, screamed at each other. The big ones beat on the smaller ones. I was in the middle. I got it from above. I made sure I gave it down. And so they told me I was not a cute baby. I was born sort of complaining all the time. From what I understood, my mother saying she couldn't bond with me. I was not cute at all. And I was difficult. My sister, she was 14 months older than me. Oh, she was the sweetest smile, and she was so brilliant, and she was so cute, and she was just great. You know, she passed away in her early 30s of eating disorder-related complications. They could not save her. And so just to say that there was always like a doom over our family, you know. I was troubled. My family was troubled. And I always could feel my mother's pain, and you know, as a kid, for me it was all normal. I was fine with this all. I mean, kids have this two-dimensional vision, you know. You just want to grow up. That's all you want to do. If you get beaten, yelled at, okay, it's traumatic, but boom, you want to go ahead. And so I was, you know, and this pain of my mother, like, oh, it hung over the household like doom. And I really would have chopped off my arm. I could have made her happy. And no, nothing. The household was just like industrial. We needed live and help. Sometimes even two. The children, the sick children, they needed 24-hour care until they were 5 years old. And my dad was a businessman from Iran. He was business. He was building a business. My parents worked really, really hard, and we had to all work really hard too. And there was no, I don't want to do it today. If it wasn't happening, you got yelled at, you got beaten. I mean, you know, it was those times back then. And then, of course, our household was extremely crazy. And I was terribly afflicted. I've never experienced addiction like the chemical kind, where they say it's physical. My addiction was always, from the beginning, centered in my mind. And I was a nail biter. I was biting my nails. I was not a normal nail biter. I was biting my nails so badly that my fingers tips were swollen and bleeding. And as when I was young, very young, I remember sitting in my bed even and biting my toenails. I mean, that's how bizarre I was, you see. And my parents, you know, tried everything. If you stop doing this, we give you an oh, great, I'm going to be rich, you know. And I knew I was going to quit this. I knew I was, because I was going to get. And I just counted my riches. You know, this was my first experience of just major, major failing. I really wanted to stop doing it, and I could not. So I had already the experience of failing already as a little kid. And then, you know, it is not the failing anymore, but then the guilt that goes with it, right? So I was this kid I always wanted, needed, wanted, like my friend John T. says, you know, I need it, I want it, I need it. I don't know what it is, but I want it anyhow. This just really was me before any substances were introduced, you know. So I did some ugly stuff. I went to the fridge and I just take one spoon of cream, you know, from the, we had these milk bottles. We were the children, the chick children. Everybody needed to get fed. And then just one spoon of cream. And before I knew it, I opened all the milk bottles and I just shoveled the entire cream. And they said, you don't do that. You share. And you, the kids are starving in Africa. And I'm, oh, God, yeah. And I saw these pictures, you know, from the UNESCO and the Christmas. They would show these starving, dying children. Oh, my heart went out to it. You know, I could not stop. On my own will, I had this huge will of want, and I could not stop. Well, anyway, you know, the Beatles came, I had a cool aunt, she was the first to have her skirts shortened, and I thought, oh, this is so cool, and hot pants, and music, and the hippies. I was impressed with the hippies. The colors, their dresses, I thought the hairstyle, but this is so cool. I just fell in love with Janis Joplin, and I couldn't understand a word she was saying. And I just thought, oh, she became my idol. That is how empty I was. May I say it? You know, I really was outforming myself now. I wanted something out there. I wasn't concerned with what was going in here. My family, I didn't like them. They were not cool. And they had no fun. And then my dad, he bought a piece of land at the ocean side. And then they put on a manufactured home. Everything was so uncool, right? And we had to go there. Every weekend, every vacation. My other friends in school, they were going skiing. They were having fun. They were going to the sunshine. Oh, I hated it, you know. And then I remember instances where I just decided I would never forgive them. I didn't even know the concept of forgiveness yet. I couldn't even really verbalize what that was. Forgiveness, unforgiveness. I just knew, oh, you know. And I had this energy. I couldn't be stopped. I disrespected everything my parents said, and I just, you know, went out on my own. My friends had little parties in their parents' basements, and there were mattresses on the ground, and we were smoking cigarettes and drinking beer and just actually listening. Music was the thing, and I was so brainwashed. I thought that was so cool. You know, if I think about it today, it was nothing. And I just wanted to be there. So I snuck away, I ran away, and then my parents, oh, God, you know, it was a drama. You're not our daughter anymore. You're not coming back into our house. And then I stayed with a friend. Social services got involved. They interviewed us. My mother was hysterical. My mother was always hysterical. My mother threw these tantrums. She had these nervous breakdowns, screaming, yelling. Sometimes she would be yelling for 2 hours. And my sister and I just, And she just, she was sick, you know. I didn't know this. I took everything everybody said personal. You know, I thought, why is she hating us so much? Why is she hating me? Me in particular, you know, I got to hear these things like, you know, yeah, you are no good, you know, you're just like your father. And, you know, when I later fell in love with this heroin addicted husband, and what brought me to my knees was that codependency. I was so highly codependent, and I started drinking just to kill myself, to kill my pain. That codependent pain was so ruinous, and it was the worst addiction anybody could, I believe, experience. I mean, I did not drink to enjoy myself. I drank to die. I could not get from my husband what I wanted. I thought we needed to have this happiness. This happiness was never going to come. And then I found I was like my mother. I threw these tantrums exactly like her. Exactly what I didn't want to be, you know. My sponsor says, watch out whom you hate, because you become what you hate. And most likely you are already what you hate, so watch out. And you know, that's what we are doing here in the program. We resentment is the number one offender. It's not so much what we do. So if people say, now I do the next right thing. No, we don't do the next. This doesn't exist. As the book says, we pray for his guidance to show us what the next right thing might be. We don't know what the next right thing is. When I ask us whether we are now, Susan, you're not supposed to know. You know, you turn that over. And I just almost died. I got really sick, and I think it prepared me for this program. It took years later. I did divorce my husband, and I'm glad I did, you know. It took me a long, long time to what they call to build that new freedom. That new happiness, you know, nobody really knows what that is, you know. Happiness, my sponsor said, you know, Susan, happiness is if nobody and nothing can take that happiness away from you, even when the situation gets really ugly and tough. And that's what happiness is, you know. You hold your ground, you never get upset, you never have resentments, you love people by not hating them. And I began to understand and learn a completely new concept of what this is about, you know. It's good to know that you don't know. That I was just stamped into my brain. It took me years to finally feel that freedom. Yeah, it's good to know that I don't know. Isn't that wonderful? I mean, it just drops all pressure and all fear off me. Yeah, and there's one. I can always ask my Father in Heaven, you know, what am I going to do next? What do you have in mind for me? How can I be helpful? Okay, to end this, you know, with a sponsee, I really admire that. I was years in the program. I went to the early morning 6 o'clock meeting, Berkeley Fellowship. I mean, I was hardcore, you know. And a woman came in, and she talked about she had a family, a house, children, and she talked about so sweetly how she was drinking her cooking wine. And then she got tips before the guests came. And you know me, I thought, oh, you know, you don't need the program. That's how I thought, right? But what's she saying? What's she talking about? Cooking wine. And, you know, years later, Kathy was her name, you know, years later, Kathy kept being in the program. She spoke a lot of meetings. She had always a minimum of 10 sponsees. And I thought, oh, was I wrong, you know? And I went up to her after she spoke. And I asked her, Kathy, I don't know how to do this stuff. I don't have the capability. I don't have the intellect to work with people or the know-how. She said, Susan, you don't have to. It's all exactly written in the book. The first 164 pages tell you exactly how to work with others, what to do, what not to do. And, you know, I started joining a book study. We are very blessed here. We heard the other day of Don Brown's book study in Martinez. I was a member of that group for a little while, and unbelievable. If you want to do yourself a favor, I think we can say it's one of the finest book studies in the world. So if you want to get a taste of that, go out there. And it's blessed to be here. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.